You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Mireya Solis. I'm Senior Fellow and Night Chair in Japan Studies. And it's really a pleasure to welcome all of you to this program this afternoon, From Abenomics to Womenomics, Working Women and Japan's Economic Revival. Let me introduce a little bit the topic. I would like to highlight what the stakes are and why this is such a timely issue to be discussing today here in Washington. I think that all of us are aware about the very stark demographic trends that Japan is confronted with. We all know that the population in Japan is projected to drop very sharply, 30% by the year 2055. And we are, of course, aware of the tremendous burden that that will impose as a shrinked workforce will have to shoulder the costs of Social Security and, therefore, the tremendous challenge that this represents for the vitality of the Japanese economy. And even though everybody is aware of these challenges, of these trends, I think it's fair to say that up till now, it has been very difficult for Japan to tap on the potential of half of its population, women. I think it's really striking that when you compare the educational achievement of Japanese women, they actually do very well compared to their peers in industrialized countries, and nevertheless, more frequently, they drop out from the workforce after the birth of their first child, only to come back years later, usually as part-time workers, where they will enjoy fewer benefits and fewer chances of promotion. And I think that confronted with these prospects, many Japanese women are foregoing altogether motherhood. And this has contributed to very low fertility rates in Japan. So I think it has become a very pressing issue for Japan to be able to deliver work-life balance to both men and women in order to address these very dire demographic and economic trends. And I think it is from this point that the Abe administration has now elevated the promotion of working women to become one of its signature policies in this project of economic revitalization that is commonly called Abenomics. I don't think we've seen in the past such priority to the issue of how can we encourage female labor participation, how can we deliver this work-life balance. So the purpose of this conference is precisely to address this issue, to look at it in greater depth, and to identify the opportunities, the challenges, as Japan tries to make this very important change in its policies so that greater opportunities for economic participation are extended to half of its population. We have a very rich agenda today. First, we're going to have a keynote address by Vice Minister Muraki. Then we're going to move on to an expert panel. And finally, we're going to have a roundtable of female leaders in Japan. And it was only possible to have such a rich agenda due to the generosity, the willingness of all the participants, the speakers, to come from far away. Many of them actually came from Japan so they could be here this afternoon with us. Some of them came from closer, and some of them are actually local talent in Washington, D.C. But it's their willingness to share their expertise that has made this program possible. And as always, I want to thank the Center for Global Partnership for their support of the Japan Chair activities here at Brookings. It also enables us to bring to you these discussions, which we hope are useful to all of you. Now, let me say that at Brookings, we are deeply honored that Vice Minister Atsuko Muraki from the Ministry of Health, Labor, and Welfare has agreed to deliver the keynote. Vice Minister Muraki has had a very distinguished career. In Japan, only two females have ever been appointed to the rank of vice minister. Ms. Muraki is one of them. I think it's very important to follow her trajectory. She, after studying economics at Kochi University, Vice Minister Muraki joined the Ministry of Labor, and she held their positions of great responsibility. For example, as Director General of the Equal Employment, Children and Families Bureau, and Director General for Policies on a Cohesive Society at the Cabinet Office. I should also note that Vice Minister Muraki is a best-selling author, and I want to just show you a little bit the cover of her book. It is titled Akiramenai, which basically translates as Do Not Give Up. And it is a message of encouragement that Vice Minister Muraki extends to all the working women by sharing her own personal experiences, the challenges, the travails that she herself experienced, and therefore showing that there's a path ahead. And I have read a part of the book. I must apologize, I have not read it entirely. But I have to say that the most powerful message I got from this book is that undoubtedly Vice Minister Muraki is a top elite bureaucrat. And yet the lessons, the experiences that she's sharing with all of us really have a resonance with every professional woman out there. And I have to say they reach not only women in Japan, but also women outside Japan. Because many of the insights that you offered in that book, I felt very closely applied to my own path. And I thank you very much for writing that book and for sharing your insights with us today. Please join me in welcoming Vice Minister Muraki.
Ms. Solis, many thanks for a kind introduction. Ladies and gentlemen, it's an honor to speak here at the Brookings Institution. I'd like to take the opportunity today to explain how the administration of Prime Minister Abe is seeking to promote greater participation by women in the economy and discuss the importance of this challenge. Before that, allow me to first briefly explain how I came to be in this role. In July, I was appointed Vice Minister of Ministry of Health, Labour and Welfare under the Abe administration. This is only the second time within the Japanese civil service that a woman has held such a vice ministerial position, and the first time in 16 years. I was honored to be offered the role. Naturally, I felt some nervousness and had to think seriously before accepting, as I fully recognized the importance of the challenge and the heavy responsibility. However, I immediately forced myself to overcome any such fears. I realized that this was a great opportunity to do what I have always been telling my young female co-workers to do, to see the opportunity to grow and assume greater responsibilities whenever it comes. This has always been my philosophy. I was born in Kochi, a small city in Japan's Shikoku region. I studied at a regional university and was, I think, a serious student. Like everybody else, I also had a dream. But my dream was rather realistic. I wanted to work and be self-reliant, as simple as that. At that time, the Equal Employment Opportunity Law did not even exist. Very few private companies hired female graduates as candidates for executive positions. So I moved to Tokyo and applied for work in the national government, where gender inequality was comparatively limited. I had no relatives or friends in Tokyo to ask for support. I was on my own. But this experience, I believe, taught me how to be assertive when necessary. In 1978, I joined the Ministry of Labor, now the Ministry of Health, Labor and Welfare, where I became one of very few female employees. But compared to other ministries, the level of participation by women was greater. Above all, I was blessed to have great mentors who always kindly gave me support. Compared to major economies globally, Japan is often cited as a country with low levels of female representation. This cannot be denied. However, from my own personal experiences and as a person who has been involved in making policies to promote women's employment throughout her career, I can confidently tell you that Japan has made considerable progress. We are, however, still facing major challenges. Japan's workforce is now shrinking due to its low birth rate and aging population. It's a serious challenge that requires a serious, determined response. Many, including Prime Minister Abe, argue that for Japan to sustain economic growth, it is vital that we better integrate one of Japan's most underutilized resources, the skills, talents, and drive of its women. The demographic challenge is therefore a great chance for us to empower women. After firing the first two arrows from his Abenomics quiver, namely monetary expansion and fiscal stimulus, Prime Minister Abe announced that Japan revitalization strategy as a third arrow. Here, he stressed that creating a society in which women shine is at the core of his growth strategy. Let me briefly explain where we currently stand in terms of the participation level. We can see that Japan currently ranks 10th out of 187 countries in the Human Development Index, HDI. This means that Japan has a long life expectancy as well as a high level of education. However, we perform extremely poorly in the gender gap index, 101st out of 135 countries. This means that although Japanese women are well educated, there are not many opportunities for them to play an active role. The next slide shows female employment rates by age group. The light blue line is Sweden. The dark blue is South Korea, the pink is France, the brown is US, and the red is Japan. If we compare the red dotted line, which shows Japan data from 2001, with the red bold line, which shows the most recent data, a clear shift can be observed. We still follow the M shape, but we have taken great strides forward and will continue to do so. The M-shape means that there is still a large proportion of women who leave the labor force when they get married or give birth to a child, And then rejoined the labor force once the child was grown and there was less burden of child rearing. Looking at the total fertility rates and female employment rates among selected OECD member countries, we see that North European countries, France, the United States, and Australia are performing well. In contrast, there are some countries that rank low on both rates. I think it is clear which side we'd like to be on. Prime Minister Abe has set a goal of increasing the number of women in leadership positions to 30% by 2020. This is what the numbers look like today in a few chosen sectors. For instance, the percentage of women who have reached director position and above in the National Civil Service, like myself, is only 2.6%. The data clearly shows the importance of making it easier for women to continue working and be promoted to higher positions. As I mentioned earlier, promoting women's participation in society is a key pillar of the nation's new growth strategy. First of all, among the efforts currently underway in Japan, Prime Minister Abe is now asking the private sector to raise the number of women holding executive positions. To start with, he has asked firms to appoint at least one woman to their boards. We have received positive feedback on such proposal from three major business organizations representing several thousands of companies nationwide. In fact, when I visited Mr. Yonekura, the chairman of the Japan Business Federation, for the first time as vice minister, our conversation began with how to promote the appointment of women to executive positions. This, I must tell you, is unprecedented. Questions regarding greater female participation have started to be raised in shareholders' meetings. Some companies are responding and setting clear goals and plans for appointing female executives. My colleagues at the ministry are also busy working closely with the private sector to promote this policy. Clearly, the effects of Prime Minister Abe's policies are being seen across different parts of the economy, demonstrating his leadership in seeking to achieve his goals. Second, it is also vital to ensure child care is available to those who need it. In Japan, every family is eligible to apply for child care arrangements. And at present, more than 2 million children are enrolled. The quality of service is equally high, regardless of income level. High-quality child care was a major reason why I was able to continue working after giving birth. Like myself, there are many mothers who want to send their children to daycare center and return to work. However, in Japan, demand for child care far exceeds supply, and waiting lists are very long. This shortage is a serious problem that is often cited as hindering women from participating in society. Demand is continuing to increase, and Prime Minister Abe has made resolving this issue a key part of growth strategy. The Abe administration has made it a goal to eliminate child care waiting list. To do so, we will ensure childcare is available to a further 200,000 children over the next 2 years. By 2017, when childcare demand is expected to peak, their additional childcare arrangement will be available to around 400,000 children to help address latent demand. By doing this, we expect to be able to raise the enrollment rate to the same level as Sweden or France. Realizing this aim will require substantial financing. Japan aims to ensure a stable revenue source for the improvement and stability of social security at the same time as restoring our financial soundness. A key part of this strategy will be to direct consumption tax revenues. These should go not only to the medical treatments, pensions, and elderly care that are needed in our aging society, but also toward countering our falling birth rate. I myself, as the person leading the department in charge, have been involved in enacting related legislation. Third, it is important to develop a working environment that encourages men to play a more active role in parenting. Recently, a group of Diet members, including Health Labor and Welfare Minister Tamura, formed an unofficial non-partisan group called Ikumen Giren, or Union of Child-Raising Men, in English. Another similar example is the Kosodate Dome, or Childcare Coalition, consisting of governors, including one who took paternity leave while in office. In Japan, men who actively play a role in raising their children are known as ikumen. This is a new term combining men with ikuji, the Japanese word for childcare. Incidentally, I am very happy to call my husband the original ikumen because he was always there helping out with child raising, doing laundry and cooking long before it became more common for Japanese men to do so. I can tell you that his paella and roast beef are the best. The government is actually supporting these trends, for example, through revisions made in 2009 to the Child Care and Family Care Leave Law that provides mothers and fathers with greater access to leave and reduced hours to support childcare activities. To ensure that those who take childcare leave feel comfortable and secure and able to enjoy parenting, it is important to secure their income. Under the current system, employees are guaranteed to be paid 50% of their wages during their leave. Under the instruction of Health Labor and Welfare Minister Tamura, we are considering the possibility of increasing this amount. In the growth strategy, Prime Minister Abe suggested extending child care leave from 1 to 3 years. This raised concerns from some in Japan that he was encouraging women to basically leave work for 3 whole years. I'd like to take this opportunity to say that this is not the case. The child care leave extension is intended as an option. And he has called upon the business sector to make it easier for mothers and fathers to either take childcare leave or work in reduced hours. until the child is 3 years old. This strategy is also backed by measures to expand childcare facilities and provide retraining to help parents resume their careers smoothly after the gap. There are many value sets and ideas regarding what a family should be. In considering which policies will be suitable, Prime Minister Abe is sure to listen to various opinions and respond thoughtfully and flexibly. It is very important for women to speak up clearly. After all, he's not a woman. Fourth, we need a better work-life balance. In Japan, laws such as the Equal Employment Opportunity Law and Child Care and Family Care Leave Law constitute a solid foundation for greater participation by women in society. And there's no difference between men and women in terms of competence. But in reality, many Japanese women still often find themselves shouldering a greater part of family responsibilities, such as childcare and household work. In addition, due to the expectation that full-time employees work long hours, women often have no choice but to step back from full-time work. To resolve this problem, we must continue creating a good work-life balance for men and women. In Japan, the government, together with labor unions and employers' organizations, drafted a work-life balance charter to set the direction. They are now taking action to promote the initiatives. While Japanese society at large recognizes the need for a healthy work-life balance, implementing it can be a different story and very challenging. If I were asked what the worst enemy was in my attempt to build my career, without hesitation, I would answer that it was the long working hours. I'd be very interested to hear your thoughts on these matters and to return to Japan with ideas for effective solutions. Finally, it is essential to make it possible for a woman to pursue her career for as long as she wants and that she is given opportunities for promotion based on her capabilities and experience. Whether it's on-the-job training or a qualified license, you work hard to brush up your skill. And when you reach a higher level through your efforts, you see completely different scenery and deepen your knowledge in ways you never imagined. This is the best part of having a job, the feeling that you are achieving something. I'd like to see all women grab opportunities that let them feel this fulfillment in their work. In her recent book, Lean In, Sheryl Sandberg said that women often judge their own performance as worse than it actually is. Japanese women are no exception. Japanese women also tend to build their own wall and avoid taking on bigger tasks with heavier responsibilities. I sincerely wish that they become more confident in themselves, act more assertively, and do not run away from new chances. Through the effect of measures such as those I have outlined, I'm confident that we will see advances in the role of women in Japan. We will see the society in which women shine envisioned by Prime Minister Abe come true. At a personal level, I find my job very challenging and rewarding, which I believe is very important. I not recommend to others to take an easier or less challenging job just because you are also raising children. Only when you choose a job that you find challenging and rewarding will you find the energy to continue doing it. That is why I encourage my young co-workers to accept new tasks and chances of promotion whenever they are offered. In closing, I'd like to express a commitment. As a government employee creating policies under Prime Minister Abe, and as a working mother, I will do whatever I can to realize a society where having both a job and a family is perfectly normal for both men and women. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for such an excellent speech. I found it very insightful. And I would like to take the opportunity to ask you the first two questions, and then I'll open the floor to hear from the audience as well. And the first question I have has to do with this chart you showed us. And when you remarked that the goal of Prime Minister Abe is for women to represent 30% in positions of leadership by the year 2020. And when you listed all the professions, I thought it was really striking that the National Civil Service was at the bottom with just 2.6%. So it's a very, very big gap from 2.6% to 30%. So I was wondering, given that your whole career has been within the National Civil Service, if you could share with us why you think it's such a low number and what can be done to make progress towards the target.
の一番厳しい質問が最初に来ましたけど、公務員っていうのは大変シニオリティシステム の強いところです。で私が公務員になった時のことを思い出すと、全部の省庁全部の職種を合わせて800人ぐらいが一緒に公務員になりました。そのうち女性がおよそ20人です。ちょうどそのさっきやった 2.6% の比率に近い数字です。で今は例えば私の省だと、入ってくる新しく公務員になる人の3人に1人が女性です。ですから少しもう少し時間がかかりますが、もう確実にこの政府の中の女性の管理職指導者の割合は増えてくると思います。
Well, the toughest question first. Well, first of all, the National Civil Service in Japan has a very strong seniority system. When I first became a civil servant, when I recall, there were about 800 civil servants in that year. 800 people became civil servants that year, including all the ministries and agencies. Out of 800, only 20 people were female. So it is very close to the rate you just cited of 2.6%. However, currently in my ministry, one out of three new national civil servants are female. It will take some time, but definitely we will see the improvement of the ratio of the Japanese female civil servants taking the leadership role. It will take time, but it will happen.
Thank you very much. And if I can ask just one more question, please. You mentioned in your speech that when you started working, the Equal Employment Opportunity Law was not yet in place, and that if you have that long-term perspective, things have indeed improved for women in Japan, but still significant challenges and differences and gaps remain. And I'm thinking in particular perhaps about the wage gap, and that women in Japan that do similar jobs are simply not paid at the same level as men. So I wonder, when you look at the Equal Employment Opportunity Law, what would you say in the 20 years plus since its enactment? What would you say are its main accomplishments? And where are the new frontiers so that the gaps can be closed? Would this require changes to the law or changes in the way it is implemented?
均等法ができて20年以上が経ちました。均等法の前には、女性は採用してもらえなかったり、結婚したり子供を産むと辞めさせられるということがありました。ですから均等法ができてからそういう差別はなくなりました。ですから均等法の前はキャリアを積もうと思ってもできなかった。で、均等法ができてからはキャリアを積むという選択を女性ができるようになった。で、今日本では女性が あらゆる仕事に進出をしています。で、企業も女性にできない仕事があるとか、それから、女性が能力が低いと思っている人はもう誰もいないと思います。で、どうしましょうか、続けますか。
Yes, it's been more than 20 years since the Equal Employment Opportunity Law has implemented. Prior to that law, the women were not able to be employed. Or when she got married or had the first child, then she was forced to quit her job. So because of the Equal Employment Opportunity Law, that kind of institutional discrimination, that kind of discrimination does not exist anymore. So before the Equal Employment Opportunity Law, the women, even though they wanted to have a career, they were not able to pursue any career. Now they are able to choose to pursue a career. In Japan now, women are in every single sector and they are in every field. And I don't think there is even one single person in Japan or in the companies in Japan that women are inferior to men in terms of capability, or I don't think anybody believes that there is any field that women cannot perform as well as men.
So, そういう意味で残された課題というのは、仕事もできるし家庭も持つことができる、その両方をできるようにするというのが残された課題だと思っています。で、日本の女性の賃金は今男性の 70% です。で、この差の要因というのはほとんどが、途中で辞めてしまうことに基づくものと、もう一つは昇進をしてないことに基づくものです。ですから一つは保育の制度をきちんとして、 仕事を辞めずに済む、ドロップアウトをしなくていい、M 字カーブをなくすというのが一つ大事なこと。でもう一つは企業の中で女性が昇進していくということを保障をしていく、プロモートをしていくということが課題だと思います。その意味では今のアベノミクスで安倍総理がやっている政策というのは非常に的を射ているというふうに考えています。
So in that sense, the only outstanding challenges and issues that we are facing are twofold. Number one, are that we have to have a system, we have to have a society that women can have a career, can work, and at the same time can enjoy the family life, the work-life balance. Right now, the women's wage or the salary is only 70% of the men's. And the factors or the reasons for this gap is that women quit their work in the middle of the career. And there are two reasons for that. And that is the first factor. And the second factor is that women cannot get promotion. And in order to address these issues, we will have to have the enough daycare center system in Japan so that women will not have to quit their jobs in order to raise their children, so that we can eliminate the M curve. And number two, the companies will have to have a system to make sure that women can get promoted, so they're encouraging the firms or businesses to promote women. In this sense, I believe the policy under the Abenomics are right on.
Thank you so much, Vice Minister Muraki. So now I would like to open it to the floor for questions. Our time is very limited, so I will take two questions at a time. I'll ask you to be very concise, to wait till you get the microphone and identify yourself. So I have this lady over here and that lady over there. So wait for the mics, please, and then you can ask your question. Thank you.
Thank you very much. My name is Sakura Namioka. I have two questions. How to become government employees? And the second, how they can be promoted?
Thank you. Robin White from the Foreign Service Institute. When talking about Japan's demographics, two problems or two potential solutions are, one, more women in the workplace. Another is easing immigration. And those could be linked, because in this country, when women can't find daycare, which is all too often, they often hire nannies. Any chance of loosening up on immigration, which might help women?
ありがとうございます。まず最初の質問です。公務員については、公務員の資格試験があって、比較的若い年齢の時に資格試験を受けるんですが、その資格試験を受けて、中で仕事をしながら昇進をしていく。昇進には特別な試験とかはありませんので、それは仕事の評価によって昇進をしていくということになります。
Thank you very much for your questions. About the first question, in order to become a government worker, national government worker, you will have to pass the qualification test. And you take this test relatively young. And once you are in the ministry or an agency, then you get promoted inside the ministry or agency. You do not have to take any exams or tests to get promoted. You get promotion based on your performances and the evaluation of your performance.
もう一つの、その、人口動態を考えたときに移民はどうかということで、これは日本の中でも大変議論があります。で、移民についての、一つの懸念は、日本の中ではまだ女性の力が十分使われてないということが問題になっているときに、 先に移民を入れていいかどうか、これがかなり議論があるということと、それから、もう一つは差別やいろんな問題が起きないかどうか、日本がそれを受け入れるだけの、文化的な土壌があるかどうかということです。で、デイケアセンターが見つからなければ何よという話がありましたが、日本でデイケアセンターに対する信頼度というのは非常に高い。で、今回子どものためのそういうサービスにかけるお金を消費税を財源にして 35% 増加をさせようということを政府は決めています。そうすると働く若い父親母親が安心して、子どもをデイケアセンターに預けて働くことができる、その環境は間もなく整うというふうに考えています。
The second question about the immigration, considering the Japanese demographics, the discussions are going on, very heated discussions are going on in Japan now, whether we should have a more liberal or the open immigration policy. One of the concerns expressed during these discussions is that right now, the Japanese women are not utilized fully. They are underutilized. And is it a good idea to have more immigrants, to have a relaxed immigration policy while there is still talent and resources underutilized, which are women in Japan? So that is a very big controversy in Japan right now. Number two is a question of whether there areWill be no discrimination against the immigrants. The question is whether Japan is ready culturally to accept immigrants without any discrimination. Do we have that mental and cultural infrastructure in Japan? And the second issue you pointed out about hiring a nanny if you cannot find a daycare center, well, thetrust level of the daycare center in Japan is very high, and they are very qualified. So right now, the plan is that for the daycare's center's budget to subsidize the daycare center will be increased by 35%, funded by the consumption tax.So that the Japanese fathers and mothers who can work, Japanese fathers and mothers can work without worrying about their children while their children are going to be in the daycare center. And that environment is just about to be improved and about to be established.
Thank you very much. So we have 5 minutes. I know someone who is very eager to pose a question. So the mic goes to her, but I also would like to hear from men in the room. Is there anybody, any other men in the room that would like to ask a question to Vice Minister Muraki? Don't be shy. Well, I guess you got the...
I'm so sorry. If it's 5 minutes, I don't deserve this opportunity, but I really, really thank you all, especially Brookings. I've been a regular attendant here for the last few years, but I stopped coming here, but today is my subject of interest. So quickly, I know there's nobody to talk to, and I'm an ordinary person. I had worked for Radio Free Asia, and I don't work for them anymore, so I have some knowledge about things that are going on while working and researching and translating things. And so I'm glad that I'm out of it, because I don't have to carry the burden of knowing things and not being able to do anything. So my question is, or if there's no answer, at least please work on this. And I know Japan is like all the powerful countries, very leading nations. So about a lot of youths here and different countries, about women, I mean, when I see womenomics, I see like women and economics, and no matter what, in this world, we have so many groups interest in the name of private and governmental and, things like that. But then underneath, there are so many, and there are more and more coming up. In terms of using us or the women and their offsprings, and especially, right. I think
thank
the good.
Thank you very much.
Right,
for your question.
So.
I'm sorry, just that we have to also move on to another person that raised their
okay.
hand.
Okay,
so
right.
Thank
right.
You very
so,
much.
Like, I mean, to which are the most nations that are involved in, for example, like Russia and Japan? I know they have things to do, and Soviet Union is totally destructured, as they say. I don't know how far true. So, like that, we need to do something, and is Japan doing anything?
Okay.
Or if not, will
thank
they take
you.
The lead role
you
again?
You made your point.
Okay.
Thank you very
thank
much.
You.
So the last question of the afternoon.
Hello, my name is Ruta Edis, and I'm from the Global Entrepreneurship and Development Institute. And we launched an index measuring the conditions for high potential female entrepreneurship development in 17 countries. We compared 17 countries this year, and Japan came out 12th out of 17. It was both developing and developed countries. And it came us to the conclusion that economic development is not enough. And I just want to ask the Vice Minister about her comments about, she was talking about the labor force, but the importance of highly educated women with skills going into entrepreneurship to really further contribute to the economic growth and competitiveness of Japan. Thank you.
Thank you. So we only have 1 minute left, so I don't know if you would like to share some insight on
the questions.
So this is 企業は、まあ、新しい産業を起こしていく、それから優秀な労働力をそこに移動させるということは大変大事なテーマになっていますので、女性の起業家の応援もしたいと思います。特に今注目されているのは、少子高齢化社会が進んでいるので、その福祉の分野、社会的に意義の高い分野で、新しく事業を起こしていく、利益の追求だけではなくて、地域に貢献していくようなタイプの企業も大変注目をされていて、それを応援するという動きもありますので、そういった分野でも女性を応援をしていきたいと思っています。
Yeah, thank you for your question. I have discussed mainly about the women workforce in the private sector or the government sector. However, it is also important that women become an entrepreneur and have their own business. And in the Abenomics, they are promoting and supporting to create a new industry and new businesses, and also promoting and encouraging to shift a very excellent workforce to a different sector. And now in Japan, because of the low birth rate and aging population, we are focusing on a different kind of the sector, new sector, which has a lot to do with social welfare and businesses which contribute to the society in a very great degree. So we are focusing on those businesses for the community-based businesses, and we are going to support this kind of entrepreneurship.
Thank you so much. It's been a wonderful opportunity. I think we've all learned a great deal from Vice Minister Muraki, so please join me in thanking her for coming today. Thank you very much. Thank you so much. Okay, thank you so much. So we are now going to move on to our expert panel. And I have asked the panelists for this afternoon to address two questions that I think are very important for us to better grasp the complexities of this issue. One is, I think it's important to talk about Japan in comparative perspective.
And therefore, the question is, why has Japan lagged behind other industrialized countries when it comes to promote the participation of women in workforce? What is the complex set of social, economic, and political factors that have created barriers for more participation of women? And the other one is, of course, to discuss Abenomics proposals for increasing female labor participation. What are the set of policies, initiatives, measures that the government is contemplating so that this time some real progress can be achieved? Now, we have a very distinguished group of experts to address these questions. Let me introduce them briefly. Dr. Chad Steinberg is senior economist at the International Monetary Fund, currently at the Emerging Markets Division. And he spent 4 years as regional representative in Tokyo and desk economist on Japan. And I have to say he's completely fluent in Japanese. He is also the co-author of a paper that I think has shed a great deal of light on precisely the topic we're discussing today. And all great papers start with great titles. And the title of his paper is quite simply, Can Women Save Japan? And Dr. Steinberg holds a PhD, an MPP from Harvard University, and a BA from the University of Pennsylvania. Next will come Ms. Riwa Sakamoto, who is Director of the Economic and Social Policy Office at the Ministry of Economy, Trade, and Industry. And for the past 2 years, Ms. Sakamoto has been in charge of promoting diversity management and women empowerment. I think that she has launched some really interesting, innovative programs. One of them is, for example, an award program where corporations that have the most advanced diversity management practices get recognition in order to promote, to disseminate these practices. This is known as a Diversity Management Selection 100. And she also has launched the Nadeshiko Women Empowerment Brand, which is a joint program with the Tokyo Stock Exchange market. Ms. Sakamoto is a graduate of the University of Tokyo and has also studied at the Harvard and Stanford law schools. And I have to mention that she passed the bar exam at New York, which I thought was very impressive. And then we have Dr. Frances Rosenbluth, who is Damon Wells Professor of International Politics and Deputy Provost at Yale University, and is widely regarded as one of the top Japan scholars. So it's a real pleasure to have her here. A large body of her work focuses on the question of the politics of gender inequality. She has authored many books, but there's one that's actually very much on target for today. That is a co-authored monograph, Women, Work, and Politics, the Comparative Political Economy of Gender Inequality. Dr. Rosenbluth holds a PhD and master's from Columbia University, and her BA is from the University of Virginia. So what we're going to do is we're going to ask the panelists to come each at a time in the order in which I introduce them to do their presentation from the podium so that they don't block the screen in case they're using a PowerPoint, and after that we'll all come to the stage and start the discussion and the conversation. Thank you very much. So Dr. Steinberg, thank you.
Can I just use this? Will it come up? Okay, so while we wait for my PowerPoint to get up here, let me first of all just thank you very much for the invite. It's really a privilege and an honor to be on this distinguished panel. Invites don't come so much to the IMF, at least for middle-level staff. It usually goes to the upper-level staff, but I'm very happy to be here. I also, is someone going to load up my presentation by any chance, or do I need to do that? Yeah. Okay, so I'll just keep on going with the introduction. I mean, one thing I have to say at the start is that they make us give this disclaimer right at the front that the views expressed herein are not of the IMF or not of the executive board or of its management. Now, that said, everything that I'm going to say here today is more or less, you know, in line with the last staff report on Japan. So I'm not going to stray too far from the original policy line, but if you're taking quotes, please don't say IMF says. Yep. Now, let me give you the three sections of my presentation. I'll try to be quick because I think we only have 15 minutes each. But I want to give some motivation about why we're working on this. I want to give you a little bit of ideas about the cross-country evidence. What does it say? And then I'll give you some of the Japan-specific hurdles that we identify in our paper. I must say that the Vice Minister already touched on some of these issues, but I'll retouch on them a little bit. I also have to say, because you said that my title was very great, but actually that title came from one of my colleagues, so I can't take all the credit for that. And now, actually, the IMF is using it for the world. They're saying, can women save the world economy? So it's catching on. Not quite as good as Albinomics. Okay, so let's start with a few slides on the motivation and why we thought this would be an interesting paper. Now, as you can see in the left-hand side graph, Japan is aging faster than anywhere else, with population projecting suggesting that the share of the population over age 65 will rise from 9% in 1980 to 36% in 2040. Now, the consequence of this, as many people have said, is that the rapidly aging society is that you'll really have a sharp decline in the labor force, right? The size of Japan's labor force, what you can see on the right-hand side, peaked at about 87 million in 95. Now, given current population trends, it will be about 55 million in 2050. Now, that 55 million is about roughly the same size as the labor force was at the end of World War II. So we saw labor force go way up, and now it's going way down. Now, the consequence of that is clearly is that unless output per worker rises at a faster pace to offset this decline in the number of workers, Japan's GDP is likely to fall behind that of many of its neighbors. It's already fallen behind China, and it'll likely fall behind other countries as well. Now, that's a negative view at the start, but things aren't completely negative. There's still much Japan can do to help mitigate the decline in the size of its workforce. Now, I like to put a little cartoons in my presentation, just it adds a little bit of amusement, but most Japanese will know that this is the Sazae-san family. It's Japan's longest-running animation series, and in many ways, it represents a typical or ideal family in 1960s Japan. The older couple and the younger couple live together, and the grandmother helps the younger couple take care of the children. They're basically two caretakers. But now, families have tended to migrate to major cities, so the younger couple moves to Tokyo or Osaka, and leaving the parents behind. Now, what happens is that the housewife subsequently has no one to help out with watching the children. And without the development of support centers, like childcare, she has very limited choices concerning work. Since she has to stay home and watch the children, as a result, labor market is losing out on a highly educated resource. Now, in some ways, the future of Japan depends on the little girl, Wakame. Right? Now, she's not really the daughter of Sazae-san. She's the daughter of the grandmother, but that's a long story. But, I mean, I guess the answer is just, you know, if policies are supportive of more participation of women in the world, she may end up choosing a very different path than the other women in her family. Okay, so now that we said something negative, something positive, let's see what we can get. So now if you look at FLP rates across the OECD, Japan scores poorly. Ooh, that's not showing up very well. Okay, well, I apologize. The left-hand side graph is very hard to read. But this is particularly noticeable when you look at labor participation rates in the comparison of males and female. The labor participation rate for females in Japan is 25 percentage points lower than for males, with most countries showing differences about 10 percentage points. And if we compare against northern European countries, it's about 5 percentage points. So I know it's hard to see that graph, and for some reason, this must be an older version of PowerPoint, is that Japan is the second bar, right? So Japan and Korea are really bad, other countries about 10, northern Europe 5, right? So our simple point was that getting more women in the workforce would mean not only a larger labor force, but possibly a more skilled labor force, given that Japanese women, on average, have more years of schooling. Now, when we just do some simple back-of-the-envelope calculations, we show that if Japan were to raise its labor participation rate for women to the level of other G7 countries, the right-hand side graph, they could raise permanent level of GDP by about 4%. Now, if you were going to go one step further and raise it to the level of Denmark, Norway, and Sweden, then you might get another 4%. So the punchline there is that in the medium term, you can raise the level of GDP possibly by 8%. Now, these are very, you know, simple calculations and then don't take a lot into effect except for the fact that we're going to have more labor in the workforce. Now, is this unheard of? Not really. We've seen a transformation of this magnitude in the Netherlands, for example, where they had a similar dramatic increase in the past few decades. Okay, now I want to switch gears a little bit and start talking about the cross-country evidence. Now, the left-hand side graph shows the distribution of labor participation rates in the OECD at 2 points. 1985 is the blue line, and 2005 is in red. What you can see is that across the OECD, FLP rates have indeed been rising, with the mean and the distribution increasing from about 61% to 77%. At the same time, participation rates have started to converge, with the width of the distribution narrowing considerably, right? So you see the blue distribution is very wide, you know, all different types of countries with all different types of participation rates. You see the red distribution, it's very narrow. You know, many countries are having much more similar participation rates nowadays, and the mean has moved up. Now, Japan has also increased its participation rate, but at a much slower pace than the median country. So as a result, within the distribution, Japan has lost ground to many of its peers. Before, Japan was kind of near the top of the distribution, or the middle, right? And now it's in the back, right? It's losing ground. Now, what we believe is that demographics play an important role in explaining these changes. In our analysis, we hone in on three variables of interest and that are easy to measure. We look at marriage rates, the number of children per woman, and education levels. Now, lower marriage rates and fewer children reduce the opportunities for home production and therefore increase the attractiveness of market work. Meanwhile, a higher level of education strengthens the attachment of women to the labor market by increasing their potential earnings. Now, the right-hand side graph basically shows that these have increased hand-in-hand with female labor participation rates. And indeed, when we look at changes over time within countries, demographics explain a good part of the increase in labor participation rates. In Japan, for example, the reduction in the number of children per woman explains most of the change. Now, while demographics are important, they're increasingly less in explaining differences across countries. This is particularly noticeable in the relationship between the number of children per woman and female labor participation rates. In 1980, the cross-section of countries shows a somewhat negative correlation. And this would fit well with what most people say in the past, right? If you increase the number of women workers, you're going to have few children, and then that's worse for demographics, right? But if you look at that same picture in 2008, right, you don't have the same correlation going on, right? It's not clearly a negative correlation. And what we think this possibly highlights is that the importance of demographics diminishes or changes as countries' demographics more or less converge. Most advanced economies have similar demographics at this stage, or much less different than they were in the past, especially if you go back and look at the histograms that are on the left-hand side here. Now, the corollary to that is, if demographics aren't going to explain why countries are different, is that the onus for closing gaps in female labor participation rates is on policies. Okay. However, we weren't very good at identifying a single policy is going to work, right? There's no silver bullet, right? There's nothing that's going, you know, Japan can't increase the number of childcare centers and all of a sudden it's going to have labor participation rates equal to the U.S., right? Policy can make a difference, but the results are varied and are not as robust or as economically significant as the previous demographic results. One reason is that the data is not so great, but it's hard for us to pin down any single story. Furthermore, one standard deviation in any of these policy variables that we have, for example, up here on the left-hand side, usually lead to less than a 1 percentage point increase in labor participation. Still, don't get too negative, you know. Our analysis does have some interesting statements, right? First, we find that wage gaps between men and women and expenditure on childcare are very good predictors of the more recent cross-section, right? So differences in how much a country spends on childcare and differences in that wage gap can explain a large part of what's going on. Second, women have strong preferences for part-time work. So labor participation is significantly higher in countries with a higher share of part-time workers, which allows women to balance both market work and family responsibilities. Now, it may be that part-time work is not leading to larger labor participation, but simply that more labor participation leads to more people wanting part-time work. Third, leave policies have to be generous. Given women, increasing leave policies from 3 weeks to 4 weeks after you have a kid is not exactly very helpful, right? If you want a woman to be able to come back to the same job, you need to give her a year off. It's very hard to measure exactly how many years you need, but small changes at the lower end under a year are not extremely helpful. Now, the fourth point is that we like to use tax incentives and cash payments in lots of different countries, but we find those things tend to only help for lower-income households or for areas with lower education. Now, we didn't look at individuals. We looked at countries, so we can't say that for sure, but I mean, you can interpret this to mean is that, you know, the cash handouts and tax incentives should be mean tested in some ways, and, you know, you shouldn't be giving cash handouts to people working on K Street. Okay. Now, these are the type of policy conclusions we can get from the data. But unfortunately, the regressions do not tell us why Japan is different, and that's what everybody here is trying to find out. Now, the model helps explain the recent rise in participation rates due to demographics, but the model does not convincingly capture the characteristics of Japan's economy that set it apart in cross-country comparisons. We think this is perhaps related to elements of the labor market that are not captured in the model, and some of the things that the vice minister was just touching on. And two of the things that we think are quite important are the initial decision into the workforce at the beginning of a woman's career, and second, the flexibility of work once women have children. Now, I'll touch on these real quick because I think the other... Ooh, I only have 2 minutes. I have two slides. I'll be able to do it. Okay. So the first challenge that we highlight is higher FLP rates is limited opportunity to enter career positions, as we just said. The most important individual labor market decision in Japan is typically made following graduation from university. For women, the key decision at this juncture is often between non-career positions and career positions. Career positions pay more and usually include significant investment in human capital. Non-career positions, in contrast, are filled predominantly by women, pay less, and usually include less demanding tasks, and importantly, have little investment in human capital. The result of this hiring system is that there's very few women in career path positions. So if you look at this survey from the Ministry of Health and Labor, we found that women make up just 6% of employees, and the share of women in these careers... Although this share has been rising, it's risen by just very little, right? So if you see the left bar set, right, you have 6% now, and it's come up maybe 2 percentage points. Now, the result of all this, I think, is the right-hand side graph, which shows that there's very few managers in Japan. I think it's 9% versus the U.S., which is 43%. So 1 minute, 1 minute per slide. Yeah, okay. So then what I want to... transition here into is the second hurdle of women's careers, usually when they return to work after childbirth. Now, the vice minister already showed this M graph, but it's interesting to talk about it a little bit again. So if you look at this M graph, you see that Japan has FLP rates similar to other countries in their early 20s, but the participation rate drops off sharply for women in their late 20s. The unfortunate reality is that even today, roughly 60% of Japanese women quit working after giving birth to their first child. This partly reflects women's weaker attachment to the labor market due to the issues discussed in the previous slide, including lower wages and fewer opportunities for career advancement. So if you're in a career job, you're not that likely to drop out. You're going to try to stay in your career. But if you're in a job that's part-time and you're only working as a, they use this term office lady sometimes in Japan, it's not very nice. But if you have like a lower level job, you're not likely to come back into the workforce. right? So the type of job that you have before you drop out is quite important, but also what type of support systems you have as a working mother is also important. So when I showed you the picture of the Sazai-san family at the beginning, right, if you were living with your mother, you'd be able to have your mother help out with the kid. But now the family is living by themselves in Osaka or Tokyo, and they have nobody there to help them out, right? They're all by themselves, right? So in this, we concentrate on childcare just a little bit. Now, one reason that women find it tough to balance work and family is that the usage of childcare and early educational services in Japan is still very low by international standards. Meanwhile, while the demand for daycare centers has increased with the rising number of two-earner households, demand has largely been outstripped by supply. Now, the Koizumi government tried to fix that, right, in the 2000s, and they raised childcare by quite a lot. I know, I'm about to stop. And... But I think what you read, we don't have official statistics, but what you read, like if you read the Nikkei, one report says that, you know, demand outstrips supply by almost a third, right? So that's quite a large number, right? Now, we suggest that increasing the supply of childcare facilities can help with women dealing with these issues. We have many other suggestions in our paper. And I suggest you go read them if you're interested. But I just want to come back to maybe what the key takeaways are of this presentation. I think first, raising labor participation seems like an easy win for Japan, right? It's, you know, of Abenomics, that seems like the easiest thing to do of all the things that they have to do, right? Two, cross-country evidence does not point to any one policy intervention, so doing one thing is not going to solve the problem. And three, when we specifically look at Japan's problems, we see that there is a need to even the playing field in the labor market and also make it easier to balance work and family. Now, if you want to see further reading, I suggest our working paper. It's also an FND article, and it's been translated into Japanese, the full working paper by NHK at one point, and it's available on our website. Also, I'd like to note that this week, the IMF has come out with a staff discussion paper on a broader topic about women in the world. So similar to the professor's book, we start with the same type of title, Women and Work, and we just add economy at the end instead of, I think yours was politics, I'm not quite sure. But okay, so that's it from my end. Sorry for going over.
Good afternoon, everyone. As Mireya introduced, I've been working for promoting women empowerment from the standpoint of economic policy. And it's my great pleasure to be here in this prestigious conference. This is my today's agenda. And first, let me introduce a little bit the background of METI having started the efforts to promote working women. In 1960 to 70, Japan was in the rapid economic growth period when the working age population was increasing. At that time, Japan was still a catch-up economy. So the cooperation strategy was simple, mass production with increasing the market share. But the economic situation was rapidly changed after the bubble burst around 1990. After 2000, the working age population finally started to decline. Then Japan's economy got into serious deflation. Under this situation, the Japanese manufacturing companies have been forced to take a more defensive strategy, cost-cutting for maintaining the profit with slowdown in sales. This is the historical change of Japan's FLP rate. It is generally said that the Japanese standard family model was formed in the era of the rapid economic growth. This model may have been well suited to the business strategy at that time to some extent. Actually, the FLP rate was the lowest in 1975 at the end of the rapid economic growth period. Since then, it has been increasing as the share of the service industry increased. Viewing this historical change and the current structural problem, METI announced this vision of economic society titled Maturity and Diversity, Value Creation Economy in June last year, preparing for the Abenomics coming, actually. In order to slip out of the cost-cutting competition, the vision showed a new model, value-creating innovation. However, Japan's traditional employment structure, a rigid and uniform full-time worker model based on lifetime employment, has hindered development environment for value creation. Under this model, regular male workers whose spouses are house workers who can be exploitable anytime, 24 hours, anywhere, assumed to be standard. Such male employees work excessively long hours, but recently their productivity per hour has been declining. A new vision proposed creating a society where various human resources, especially women, can participate in value creation and realizing the double income toolkit lifestyle. The government officially estimated that if potential female workers, about 3 million people, actually worked, they would earn about $70 billion, which corresponds to 1.5% of Japan's GDP. I think this estimate seems rather modest compared to other estimates by, for example, Goldman Sachs and Mr. Steinberg's report, because this is based on the assumption that the gender gap of average income is as it is now. And now I'm going to discuss the issues and government programs. This is the whole picture. There are problems of women labor in Japan, both in quantity and quality. The quantity issue is that as many as 60% of women quit jobs at giving birth, mainly due to the difficulty of work-life balance and notorious M-shaped curve problem. The quality issue is that women's potential is not fully utilized, and the women's share at the decision-making level is extremely low. The so-called mommy-struck problem is often pointed out. Both issues, if improved, we can expect the synergy effect between each other. But my personal view is that the efforts to address the quantity issue, mainly by Ministry of Welfare, has gone ahead. On the other hand, the quality issue is behind because it's part of each company's management matter, so difficult for the government to reach or control directly. Now I will explain the major programs to address the quantity issue and then discuss about the quality issue. This is the Japanese family support system. Basically, the legal requirement is 12 months or in some cases 18 months childcare leaves and a 3-year shortening of working hours for all employees. In that sense, the situation is better than here, I think. In large companies where such measures have been fully established, it's said that female regular employees rarely leave their jobs due to having a child. On the other hand, in many small, medium-sized enterprises, it is still difficult for female employees to actually use the measures. Let's move on to the problem of childcare waiting list. Vice Minister explained about this issue, so here I'm going to focus on the diversification of service providers. On the right side, this is the graph of the share of each category of operating bodies. Business corporations occupy only about 1%, even though they were legally allowed to operate the services 13 years ago, not a few municipalities have been reluctant to certify them, actually, saying that they are not reliable for continuing the services. However, last May, Ministry of Welfare again sent official document to request for certifying various bodies, typically business corporations, on equal footing to all municipalities. Then we can see the positive change in the most conservative municipalities. And I skip this. And this is the program menu of the urgent program. And I'm not going to get into details, but I can say that this covers all important issues. So we can expect a big progress if it's properly executed. Okay, that's okay. I lost one page, but I can explain. Now I will discuss the quality issue. About 10 years ago, as Mireya mentioned, the Japanese government set the national goal of having no less than 30% of leadership positions in all areas of society filled by women by 2020. But now, only 11% in managerial positions and 1.4% in board members. Regarding this issue, I often hear from HR managers of large Japanese companies, such as the problem is excessive use of family support, which makes it difficult to promote women's career development. Or, under this Vice Minister mentioned about public servants, under the seniority system, it takes time to increase the number of female managers, because most Japanese large companies started to employ a reasonable number of women for career track, 総合職, only after 2000, so it takes time. And another typical comment is, we are trying to promote women, but they tend to decline challenging offers. And here is a chart showing a vicious cycle of discouraging the promotion of women, which can be seen in many Japanese companies. Male managers, unconsciously influenced by the traditional idea of the stereotyped gender role, tend to refrain from assigning challenging missions to female workers. Then female workers' motivation goes down even before having a child. Then when they face with the work-life conflict, they tend to leave jobs or become low performers. Looking at them, male managers believe, again, female workers are not reliable. This, some experts point out this is a mechanism of statistical discrimination. In order to cut off such a vicious cycle and create opportunity for business people from top to HR managers, find diversity as an important source of competitiveness, METI, my ministry, launched the Diversity Management Selection 100 last year, aiming to promote diversity management by collecting best practices and appealing its importance as a business strategy. And last year, we picked up 43 enterprises from 160 applicants. This is the list. And it includes 22 SMEs. We intentionally picked up them to show that diversity works also for them. And sharing these best practices with business people, we have been making efforts to inform female students, high school and university, of these selected companies as really good companies for women to develop their careers with good work-life balance, so that some labor market pressure will promote efforts toward diversity management. These are the representatives. The first one, Shigematsu, this is Ehime Prefecture, construction company of SMEs. This is male-dominant industry, but the CEO positively recruited and assigned women to sales section and supervising sites. And then they have built a good built a good relationship with customers and improved the customer satisfaction. And the second case is Nissan Motor Company. Since teaming up with Renault, it has tackled diversity as part of overall business strategy, implementing career development support to systematically encourage development support female managers by mentoring by executive directors and distributing career advisors. And then they have succeeded in increasing the share of female managers fourfold. And the third case, Toshiba Corporation, electric manufacturer, in globalization, as part of organizational reform, it has made a progress in reforming the ways of working, which is a big challenge for most Japanese companies. By practical approach, providing a handbook on management know-how and setting the days for leaving on time to increase the work efficiency. The last case is Shiseido, the major cosmetic business company. It has gone ahead in work-life balance support, and now it's focusing on the promotion and training of female leaders, and it has achieved the increase in the number of female leaders on product development. Oh, sorry. Through publishing these best practices, we try to make business people really understand the merit of diversity for their own business. And I'm actually feeling that their minds are actually changing. And best practices in details in English is up on our website. I didn't put the address. www.diversity100sen.go.jp you can find. And METI and the Tokyo Stock Exchange have jointly launched the Nadeshiko brand program last year. Nadeshiko is a Japanese word for pink, beautiful flower like that, and it was named after Japan women's national football team, aiming to back up the efforts of each enterprise by recommending those enterprises excellent in women empowerment as attractive investment targets with potential for long-term growth for investors. Of all the 1,700 enterprises listed on the Tokyo Stock Exchange first section, METI and TSE picked and publicized 17 enterprises, one for each industry category last year. Such an approach is effective, especially for Japanese companies, because the ranking by sector can stimulate their competitive consciousness. And we introduced a pair of logo marks, you can find, for Nadeshiko brand and Diversity Selection 100 to show that they are a kind of sister project. When you find those marks on their name cards or something, please tell them it's great. Then that would be very helpful for our program. And these are the income distribution of married women. I'm sorry, it's very small. For each generation, above 30s, you can see its peak around 1 million yen. This is because many female part-time workers adjust their working hours for their annual income not to exceed the limit for tax deduction for spouses, 1.03 million yen, and exemption for social insurance fee, 1.3 million. If we want to increase the FLP rate in Japan, it's clear that we should consider reforming such a tax system. However, roughly speaking, about two-thirds of married women earn less than the limit, which means the majority of the current Japanese families benefit from this tax deduction, and also it's regarded as a symbol of social respect for a good wife who stays mainly at home and helps her husband's success. That's why it has been extremely difficult to raise this issue politically. But this time, Japan Revitalization Strategy clearly states that the government will advance the consideration on this issue. I'm expecting Prime Minister Abe's strong political leadership might be able to make a breakthrough about this hardcore issue. I'll skip. In conclusion, Prime minister's message that womenomics is the core of growth policy has surely inspired social awareness and motivated Japanese companies to promote diversity. I've heard a lot of positive comments from business people. Basically, the Japan revitalization strategy properly shows the necessary prescription, and now it's the time for execution. Lastly, the remaining issues, which I think we should focus on addressing from now on, are these two. First, as Vice Minister mentioned, work-life balance should be promoted, and I think by increasing the flexibility of working rather than over-generous family support. And second, to motivate women to pursue career development, we need to think about to create a good incentive through career education and the reviewing the tax system. Now, the social enthusiasm in Japan is surely surging. Ms. Muraki's assumption to the vice minister's position was really a good news. In order to take this big chance and get a good result, accelerating the process, I would really appreciate your continuous support for Japan's womenomics. Thank you very much.
It's a great pleasure to be here today. I'd like to thank Dr. Solis for putting this conference together. And it's a special pleasure to be here with such an august group of participants and presenters, Vice Minister and former Minister Kawaguchi as well. I am pleased to have this kind of wrap-up job, I guess you could say, because the people who just went before me have said an enormous amount, and that reduces what I have to say. From current slide, start. Okay, here we go. I have a very simple message, I think, that has come out from what people have said already, and that is, time is money. That is, the time for work brings higher wages. And women in today's society, and perhaps particularly in Japan, have less time to provide the workforce because of the expectations that they play a bigger role in the family. It's a very deep cultural, social issue. And so it's going to take some very deep structural measures to change that. This is just another way to think about the change in Japan's female labor force participation over time. As with all countries, the real driver of female labor force participation is the service sector. That is the demand for female labor now that Japan has moved from being a primarily agricultural country into one that is driven by the services. This is a cross-national picture of the relationship between service sector jobs and female labor force participation, or rather the inverse of service sector jobs. Skill specificity refers to jobs that require continual on-the-job training, which is a feature of manufacturing in particular. Service sector jobs tend to have less of that on-the-job training aspect, which is one reason there is higher demand for female labor in the service economy. We all know about this M-curve, and the good news when you see the M-curve superimposed by decade for Japan is that the M groove in the middle is getting shallower, which means that there are more women who are staying in the labor force. But as the others have said before me, this second hump of the M is of a different quality. It's of a poorer quality. It tends to be part-time work, which is great for flexibility, but it really is the second best. It means that the full-time jobs are no longer available and women are settling for part-time work. To echo what the others have already said before me, there is no magic bullet. There is no single solution. This is a cross-national picture of spending, government spending. Actually, it's children and formal child care, but it reflects government spending for public child care facilities. So what percentage of children are in child care facilities? What this shows, when you see Japan in comparative perspective, is that Japan is punching below its weight, as it were, when it comes to the effectiveness of spending on child care for results of seeing women move into the labor force. Why is that? Why is it that even though the Japanese government has put a lot of effort into expanding the number of child care facilities, it has fewer women working relative to what this regression line would suggest should be the case? So what else can Japan do to get more out of the efforts that it's already making? Obviously, child care isn't the only problem facing Japan. So one way to think about this issue of female labor force participation is that women can supply their labor more easily if there is child care, but if there isn't a demand for their labor, the child care isn't going to have as much effect. So what is it that is keeping the demand for female labor in Japan lower than it might otherwise be? I don't know how many of you remember some years ago, I think it was 1989, Mary Brinton, who's a sociologist of Japan, wrote a book called Women in the Japanese Miracle, and she was full of optimism because she felt that with the growth of the Japanese economy and the demand for labor that wasn't fully met, in part because immigration is more or less cut off by policy, this demand for female labor is really going to finally bring women into the workforce. Well, several things happened since 1989, the most important of which was an economic slump. And so the demand for labor fell off, and that escalator for women into the workforce kind of stopped for a while. Abenomics is an attempt to reinvigorate the economy and once again get this escalator going for the labor force in general and hopefully for women in particular. And that's less of a structural thing, perhaps, and more of a business cycle thing. So there's some problem with the demand for female labor. Part of it is because the economy has slowed, but what else is it? I'm going to come back to that in a minute because I'd like for you to think about it for a while, somewhere in the back of your head. And this is another slide that shows why child care spending alone can't solve the problem. This is not an intuitive, self-explanatory slide, so let me just go through it a little bit. This is a clue from the United States. These are U.S. data on the gender wage gap for women in the bottom decile, men and women in the bottom decile compared to men and women in the top decile. What that means is if you were to look at the top wage earners for men and for women, that's this top set of figures, and you were to divide up American states into these five categories of spending on child care, the U.S. states that spend the most on child care, New York and California, have a smaller gender wage gap at the bottom but not at the top. The states that have the lowest government spending, this is mostly from the states in the U.S. case, the lowest subsidy for child care have a bigger gender wage gap for the bottom decile, that is the men and women who are earning the least. But there's very little difference at the very top. What does this tell you? Does anybody have any ideas what this says about the relationship between child care and the gender wage gap in the United States? Any ideas? Anybody want to hazard a guess? Chad, you want to hazard a guess? No? Can't even put the white male in the audience on the spot. Okay. Yes. So the women who have the least income, the families who have the least income, are most dependent on government help. I think that is true. The other thing it's showing is that the gender wage gap is much bigger in the upper reaches of the wage distribution. And so in the case of the United States, who is at the very top in the American, who's at the very top in income earning in the United States? It's Wall Street, it's finance and Wall Street law. It's the professions at the very top. What is distinctive about those kinds of jobs compared to the jobs that are at the bottom, Walmart cashier? 24/7, right? The jobs at the top are extremely time-intensive, demanding jobs that require the ability to supply your labor more or less continuously. So even in the United States, which has a flexible labor market and pretty good female labor force participation and pretty good gender wage gap compared to Japan, has a real problem at the top. Because our society, not just in Japan, but in the United States too, and in Europe, is organized around the male breadwinner model, where women are expected to take more responsibility for children. That's just a fundamental fact of life on planet Earth in 2013. It's more the case in Japan, but it is nevertheless the case anywhere you go in the world. Sweden, which is a model of gender equality, has a very big gender gap in employment in the private sector. Most of the gender equality in Sweden comes from a very big public sector that hires women in large percentages, but the private sector in Sweden is still very much male-dominated, and it's the same problem that without solving that problem of the ikumen, was it ikumen? Ikumen. That's going to be our solution. Ikumen is going to be our solution to this problem. But we don't know how to create ikumen. You know, some ikumen are just there, but they're not so many volunteers so far on planet Earth. This, again, is U.S. data. And this, I think, again, provides clues for the situation in Japan as well. These are just histograms of hours worked, and it shows a big difference. These are men, and these are women, and what it shows is that men work longer hours. What happens if you work longer hours? You're more likely to get promoted. You're likely to get paid more. In fact, if you look at the return on wages, you get paid more, not just as a function of having more hours at the same wage. If you work longer hours, your wage rate goes up. Firms, particularly firms that want continuous customer care, as in Wall Street banking or Wall Street law, who want these people who are going to be on the phone at any given time of day or night, or maybe in the ministries as well in Japan, these firms require very, very long hours, and that's where the men are. Okay, so Sakamoto-san mentioned the vicious cycle, and I think that's what we've got. We've got a vicious cycle. So these are gender attitudes in Japan, and if you look at these bar graphs, you will see that in 2012, there is a difference between women and men in answering this question. Should men work and women stay at home? About 12% of women say, we agree with that. And then another chunk, up to almost 50%, say, well, we somewhat agree with that. Men are more in agreement with that socially conservative statement. So as long as the social views are that strong, it's very hard for somebody to stand up and say, I'm going to be ikumen, because that ikumen is not given the kind of respect or status or authority that the other men may be given. You can see that employed women, of course, have a view that women should also be working, and housewives are more conservative. That's not surprising. But if you look at the changes in attitudes over time in the United States, the changes came from the women who went into the workforce, then their husbands and their families, and that is over time how these gender stereotypes changed. But here's a question, and I really don't know the answer. Maybe this is just a blip, but gender attitudes have become somewhat more conservative in Japan in 2012 compared to 2007. And I would be very much interested in those who are working on the ground in Japan to understand why that's true. But here's part of the answer right here, that men aren't doing as much of the housework. And as long as women are doing this much more housework, men have a lot to lose from complete equality. All right, so thank you very much. I look forward to our conversation.
I don't want to take the time away from the audience so they can ask questions, but I just want to put out two issues that I think draw some contrast in the views that were presented, and you can address them or not as you answer the questions. One, I thought there was a real interesting contrast regarding how optimistic or pessimistic we should be about the possibility of Japan really addressing the gender gap. And I think I was really struck by Dr. Steinberg's remark that this should be the easy part of Abenomics. And when I contrasted that with the view about how deeply these gender prejudices are and the importance of the vicious cycle, I thought there was an interesting contrast regarding how easy we should be for an economic strategy advocated by the government to make a difference or not. And the other, I think, interesting issue that came across from the presentations was that We're all interested in increasing female labor participation, but that we should not see this as a women's issue alone. That, you know, I think that it has become a recurring theme that we need the equal men, that we need for the men of Japan to come on board and to agree to play these roles in the household and to agree to give women these opportunities. So I think that it would be very interesting to discuss as well this necessity to bring on board the men in Japan with this agenda. So if you have any comments on that, please feel free to respond, and if not, we'll take questions from the audience.
I mean, I just agree with the comment that I said earlier. I mean, I think it's one of the, of all the structural reforms, that seems like one of the easier ones to implement, and especially compared to dealing with the public debt issue and comparing with deflation. I think raising female labor participation rates is one of the best ways at increasing growth. And that's why we wrote the paper.
Okay. Any other comments?
Well, I think it's certainly possible, but I think it's hard.
Yeah.
And I think it's hard because it's going to be politically difficult to do what would really work, which is to perhaps give tax benefits to firms that are moving ahead on diversity. I really like the idea of singling them out and sharing best practices, but if firms have to lose money, you know, by hiring people who are going to interrupt their careers, they won't do it for a badge of honor. It has to be a real government commitment, and it has to be some punch, I think, behind it.
I mean, this is likely not something that's going to be resolved in 1 or 2 years. Of course, this is like a 20-year program, I think, for probably Japan to catch up to other countries.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. So then let me ask the audience if they have questions, if you want to raise your hand and wait for the microphone and identify yourself. We'll hear from you. Yes.
Hi, my name is Marco Sanchez. I'm a graduate student at SAIS across the street from here. I'd like to start by expressing my dislike of the term womenomics. I think it forces an issue of racial discrimination, which is very socioculturally complex, into a rigid patriarchal structure, and it makes it seem like we can address this issue through economic policy and through structural reforms. It makes it seem like, oh, well, if we had more daycare centers, then maybe women would, you know, get off their butts and go help the economy, which is not the case at all. And I'm surprised that education policy was barely mentioned, because I feel like in order to address this issue of how women are seen and perceived in Japan, we need to start with our girls in the classroom and show them that they can do a lot more. So if you can talk about what role you think education policy should play in this development. Thank you.
Anybody else? Maybe we should take one more question and then, yes?
I worked with the women of Japan from 1963 to 1973 and then wrote a book on all of this. And I find this whole discussion very disturbing today, because it suggests to me that I thought the progress that was being made even then is the conversation is almost identical to what one would have had in 1970. I think the decade of the 80s was hard because of many change economic downturn developments in Japan. But I think you're looking at where... Why don't we talk about the Japanese men? I think a great deal of what this is all about has got to do with the relationship between the sexes. The conversation is just the same now as it was in 1970. And why is there no change? I mean, one woman with a position in the government like this, yes. But when I knew Ichikawa Fusai and Ogata Sadako-san and people like that, they were women of great vigor, of great intelligence, and they moved right ahead. It seemed to me there was tremendous progress during that period of time. But now what's happened? Why has it slowed down so desperately? It's got to do, obviously, with the attitude of men. And maybe the Japanese women need to do more about changing the attitude of the men.
Any responses to the questions posed so far? Yes?
I totally agree with him. Education problem is very important. And I skipped that topic, but I would like to emphasize the importance of career education for women and men both, but especially for women, because the economic necessity, informing them the economic necessity for double income in the Japanese economy is really important. But still, I think it's not enough. So their parents tend to tell their daughters, being housewife must be the best choice for a girl. I hear that kind of episode often. But if you consider the economic situation, the reality of the Japanese economy, it's very difficult from now on for one person to support the house budget alone. So I think it's really important to inform them the real situation.
I can add a little bit to this. I mean, one of the interesting factoids that we got when we were doing our paper was that, I mean, if you look at the University of Tokyo entrance examinations, right, which is completely objective, right, there can't be any discrimination because it's just an exam, only 20% of the population is women. Right, so this is not discrimination, this is because of self-selection in some sense. And so that basically reinforces this fact that you need good role models.
And also, mm-hmm. I'd like to add one thing. The major in the university, there is a big gap. There is a big gender gap. Only 10% of women go to the science major, especially mechanical and electronical engineering. The demand is rapidly increasing for the women engineers, but still parents and teachers discourage women students to major such field.
I guess I would just say very briefly that socialization and education follow opportunity. So I think if there were more opportunities for females to have successful careers, parents will start to change what they say to their daughters and the school teachers also. And if you look at the United States, we also have this pipeline problem for females in science. Women drop out for a couple of reasons. One is that the very long years of postdoctoral fellowships hit right during reproductive years. And so they have to decide whether they're going to be putting everything into science or balance family and career. When they do drop out, it leaves fewer women to then mentor the next generation. And it creates the impression on the part of men that women aren't serious. So that creates this implicit bias then that women really aren't suited for science. It's not true. Women are just as talented at math and science. It's this lack of mentors because the reproductive years and the support around family career balance is not working for women.
Okay, very good. Yes? Yes, please wait for the mic.
KDO non-resident senior fellow at Brookings. And what about the role model? We talked about a little bit about leadership. And I saw today two outstanding leadership, you and the minister. But I don't have any statistical data, but ever since the State Department had three consecutive female secretaries, today more than 65% of the Foreign Career Service in the State Department are female. And I am working in the defense sector, security, which is dominated by male. So we created Women in International Security. So we have collective voices. So basically, not just you, but when you become senior level, reach a certain plateau, you try to mentoring. For example, my case is that the Asian American professionals is number one category, and followed by Asian American men and black minority and Hispanic minority. I don't see like a person like Sadako Ogata and all these excellent people in leadership is actually systematically, institutionally encouraging Japanese women. So maybe somehow you have to think about it. You are doing it right now, but in a much more broader sector, my comment.
Thank you very much for that comment. And I should also note that the next session is actually going to be the focus on the role models, because I think that's a fundamental piece of this discussion. Paige?
Thank you for addressing this issue. I have a couple of questions and observations, just briefly. Particularly with respect to METI, I'm wondering to the extent to which you contact or communicate with the Keidanren and other business companies, because it seems as though the very talented women in Japan do find opportunities in foreign companies and multinationals that are doing. And so it would be interesting to know whether or not you're finding the same statistics. So that's just one question. And the other is an observation about Japan typically not offering second chances that some people refer to. So when we talk about education, there tends to be this tracking system. And if you get off track, then your future is more challenging and difficult. And so for women in the United States, if they do choose to step away from the workforce, there might be not only flexibility, but opportunities to come back to their career in a different way or to start a new career, or it was already mentioned about entrepreneurship. So I guess I'm also just wondering systematically if there's any discussion about trying to change that system for men and women to have or take advantage of second choices or second chances. And then just finally, with respect to the men, I know that at least a few years ago, the Ministry of Health, Labor, and Welfare suggested that a bell chime at the end of the day in Japanese government offices and announced that it's time for everyone to go home, take care of your families, and the majority of workers were in fact men, and they continued to work because of the fear or pressure to be able to produce or to at least demonstrate their support to the work they're doing. So there have been policies put in place, and some of them are enforced and some are not, and so I'm wondering if any of you are aware of more recent initiatives to allow men to do what many of them do want to do, but find it difficult. Thank you.
Yes. Oh, and we'll take one more question from Mrs. Asai.
Well,
just oh, I'm sorry, Mrs. Asai, the microphone. Thank you.
The point raised by the Professor Rosenbluth is very valid point. That is a supply perspective, a demand perspective. Because I think the emphasis has been placed too much on the supply perspective, increase the flow of women into the labor force by increasing the child, the care facilities. But now unless the demand side is solved so that quality of the work improves, as Ms. Sakamoto, I think the problems cannot be solved in a fundamental sense. And so, for instance, the lower quality job, the women are likely to leave the workforce because there is no much incentive to stay in the course. So quality is very important, the issue. And so, and also, as the Professor Rosenblatt mentioned, the long working hours, that is such a key determinant to determine the disparity of the income or the promotion, etc. So I think what Japan has to deal with is how to increase office productivity. And Japan is very often seen as a country with a very high productivity, but that mostly in a manufacturing the sector. So how to improve the office productivity. I think that is a very important question to be addressed, and so that we just depend on the goodwill of ikumen, but generally, the institutionally, I think the women can be in a good environment conducive to the promotion and the staying in the labor force for a longer time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Very interesting comment. So I'll ask the panelists if they have any responses to the issues raised so far.
I can speak to the second chance issue. Mm-hmm. I think this is more of a general issue, not just for women, but for young as well. If people watching Japan, they know that the non-regular workforce has been growing quite rapidly in the last few decades and now makes up about a third of the workforce. So it's not just the women that are having problems with second chances, it's also the young. And of that non-regular workforce, a large proportion is young people and a large proportion is women. And you can see this when women drop out of the labor force to have children. When they come back in, only 18% get jobs again, or when they're looking. And it's even fewer for high school graduates. Now, one thing that we've been pushing to reduce that is to get more not regular jobs out there, right? Reduce the number of non-regular jobs. So there's a dual labor force in Japan going on, right? And the idea is to get the formal or the regular workforce larger rather than decreasing it over time. And one thing that we've talked about is having more flexible wage contracts where as you work for the firm for a longer time, you get more protection, but at the start, right, you don't get as much as protection as you normally would, right? Because when a Japanese person comes out of university, they expect to get this lifetime job, at least in 1980 they did, maybe not now. But, you know, that system no longer exists. But to get these jobs is quite difficult, and firms are very reluctant to hire a lot of people. And so if you made these wage contracts a little more flexible, you might be able to increase the number of regular workers.
Great. Thank you very much. I think we're at the end of our time for the panel. So could you please join me in thanking the presenters today?